looking at some of the practical aspects of church worship.
That's what the word liturgy means the public worship of God's people. And for the most part, this worship occurs inside church buildings. Please remember that any time the New Testament uses the word church, it is not referring to a place or a thing. It's referring to God's people gathering together. It's not a thing, it's a gathering of all of those who receive the Spirit of Jesus, and through their unity have a oneness. In English, unfortunately, we use the word much more for the place than for the people. So I've had to use it here, but let's remember that we are God's people. We are God's church. And that if our physical plant burns to a crisp, and the church is persecuted throughout the world, and every other church is either burnt, seized, or destroyed, building, the church remains alive. We don't need a building to be God's people. They didn't have it in the earliest days. We are the church when we have the Spirit of Jesus and are living His Spirit, with or without a building. As a matter of fact, in a certain way, the building can be both assets and liabilities. There are assets in this because we do have a church. There is some place when things are bothering you that you can just go and sit down and try to get away from the world and just withdraw into yourself in quiet and experience God. And real often, it's possible to walk into the church and you'll see people there who have brought very deep problems. Thanks to take time or praying very deeply. People coming in to talk to God about the health of others that they love, or because some problem is really disturbing. And the indices that you experience in a Catholic church. I have had quite a few non-Catholic friends share this with me, and to me it's one of the proofs of the presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. They just, without knowing anything about communion and awful attitude, they just tell me how they live near a Catholic church, and when they really wanted to pray to God, they go in there alone, because they felt something there that they didn't feel in other Christian places. Somehow, something of the presence of God. And I really think that we can just understand from this that Jesus is there. He says, "This is my body." Those words are spoken over the bread, and the bread is kept in the tabernacle. I'll explain that in a moment. So we know that the sign of Jesus is present. He's present everywhere, but sometimes we kind of lose him. We can't feel him inside ourselves. And it's real healthy to know that we can go to a church, find the tabernacle, and that Jesus himself is present there, and we can trust in his presence, even though for some reason, because of our own guilt, we can't really feel that he's with us. The church is very often remains in a church in a soft state. There would either be, could be the general shape of the building. You have an entrance way, that doesn't make sense. You have an entrance way, and something would occur there, and then you would have the altars, and those churches would be about up here. In the top part of the cross, you said you might have side altars, side little chapels in the wings, or you might have seats looking out. And then the body of the church itself. You have the entrance, you have the body,
and you have that part where the altar is. That's the third of these words, the word called the sanctuary. The word labeled sacristy is just outside the church. That's where everything that's needed for the church services is kept, where a priest would put on his vestments, where they would keep the things that are used for the Mass. And then somewhere in a church, and I'll explain this point in a moment, you'll have that section known as the choir, where it is in America and where it is in properly built churches. The entrance is simply just an entrance, except as far as architecture goes, somewhere in a church is going to be the baptistry. And the best possible place to put a baptistry is right in the entrance. The people would come up the steps, reach the entrance, then the baptistry would be slightly sunk down a step or two. They would walk through the baptistry, back up one or two steps, and then enter the body of the church, to remind people every time that it is through water, it's through an immersion, baptizing ourselves in Jesus, that we enter the people of God. If a person was designing an ideal church, that's the perfect place. And that, jumping ahead, is the baptistry then could be built with the baptistry in the baptistry in the center, and the place with water kind of overlapping it a little bit, so that it would be sitting in a little pool of water, the regular holy water, and people then entering the church could bless themselves with that water to remind themselves that this is precisely what the blessing with holy water is for, to remind us that we become part of the people of God by water, the water of baptism. Through this water, we are completely united by Jesus. The problems of the world and our own weakness drift us away from the unity that He establishes. He's one with us, but we don't really live this. By using the water, when we come in from the distractions, we can try to recapture that total re-giving of self to be loved by Jesus that we hopefully marks our unity with Him. So, holy water has a very real meaning, a very nice meaning. There's nothing automatic to it. It's a reminder of the unity that Jesus achieves with us through baptism. And I'll just, this will be on the outline somewhere else. There's holy water mentioned and some rules. It's on the second page near the bottom. A person who properly understands the baptistry and holy water should only use it when entering the church, never when leaving the church, or their visit has been a failure. The usage of holy water to bless yourself is to remind yourself that you were immersed from Jesus, taken apart from the world, consecrated, made holy through the immersion in Jesus, through the sacrament of baptism, immersion and baptism being this same word. So you re-immerse yourself in Jesus. If you've got to re-immerse yourself in Jesus when you're leaving the church, then it's time to start church searching for a new church. If the Mass has been so poorly celebrated that you've got to remind yourself that you're one with Jesus, I mean this seriously, it's time to start looking for a different community to celebrate with Jesus, if that's so great the distraction. And that's the purpose with holy water. It's nothing magic where something automatic is going to happen to you. You use the water to give yourself completely to Jesus, but that sign is made deeper in the Eucharist. Remember, baptism starts our initiation. Confirmation makes us unites us fully with the whole mission of the church, but it is the Eucharist in which Jesus Himself comes in the most complete way to give us the totality of unity. So in and through the Eucharist, we have the deepest unity with Jesus. So we shouldn't have to remind ourselves after the Eucharist that, hey, we're one with Jesus. There's nothing wrong. Nobody's going to slap your hand or say, ha ha, she blessed herself with holy water leaving a church. Look at her. Most Catholics do, because they don't understand it. They've never had explained the symbolism of holy water, what it's supposed to do for us. And they kind of would have certain little hints of almost something automatic happen, when really there is just nothing of that. So you have the entrance. Right between the entrance and the church building would be the best place for the baptistry. You have the seats. In large European churches, the great cathedrals of Europe, there are no set pews. They just have folding chairs and sometimes no chairs at all. In the past, there used to be many other altars, because one priest would celebrate one Mass. And if you had a big funeral and you want to really show how lots of priests liked the guy, each priest would be celebrating his own Mass at the same time. So you'd have, going more like to our church, up here we have the main altar and we have two side altars. So you would have had one priest, or maybe what they used to call the old high Mass, one priest celebrating assisted by two others, and then two more priests saying their own quiet Masses at side altars. That's just out. That's absolutely forbidden now. The side altars are now used for something else. The sacristy in old Catholic churches, the people sat down here, the pews ended. And then, well, that's where the pews ended, There was a rail, a communion rail. And it separated the people's section from the priest's section. And this priest section is called the sanctuary, the holier part. Because it was kind of felt that the people, you got to go back to the Middle Ages when the Mass sort of just became a drama that people looked at. We shared a little bit about this, I think, how first everybody gathered around the Lord's table and everybody shared that meal all the time. And then with the passage of time, when the language went from a Latin which everybody spoke to a Latin which people didn't understand, it began looking mysterious. And the people became aware of how holy the Eucharist was and how unholy they were, so they separated themselves. And there is, it was a low little rail, and this, the altar is the table. But the people had their own table. The people received the Eucharist kneeling. So they built a low table for the people, and that was the communion rail. But it's wrong, the whole idea. And sometimes they would even screen it off. On the other side of the communion rail, you had the altar in the old church, flat against the back of the wall. Between the communion rail and the altar in old churches was where the choir came. Now there's just one, and this is very unfortunate to have to talk about now, because to me it's a sad part of a rule. I don't like it at all. The choir isn't here in most American churches. The choir is above the rear of the church, as it is in ours. That's where the organ is. The reason for this is, by church rule, everything on the altar side of the communion rail is the holy part. And women are less holy than men, so women were not allowed in this part at all by church rule. Therefore, you couldn't have women in your choir. When they started writing four-part harmony, they would use young boys for the soprano and the alto, and unfortunately castrate some people so their voices would never drop. In America, this idea never became very popular. So, in order to get women's voices, they had to move the choir on the other side of the communion rail. This is the fact that a woman wasn't to be in the sanctuary is a man-made misunderstanding of the difference between the dignity of man and woman. And there's just no justification for it, but that's how the old church is now. So if you get into a huge church, you're going to find, you'll be a little surprised, between the people and the altar sometimes are large distances, very large, because the choir sits there facing one another. The people generally face the altar. The choir faces itself in churches like this. And they would often be part of a religious community. We talked about religious priests like the Benedictines. You go to a Benedictine monastery. The people will sit in the people's part, and all of the Benedictine monks will sit in the choir. They are the choir singing for the church service. So the people's part in the body, the sanctuary, the altar, and then, as I said, the word sacristy, just in case you ever hear the terms, where the vestments are kept. The church itself is adorned. We've always had a lot of architecture. We've always used a lot of art in the church itself, starting with the windows. Many people will say, if you go to the great churches of Europe, that the windows were the catechisms of the people during the Dark Ages when the people couldn't read. They'd look at the windows, they'd have the figures demonstrated, and there was terrific art. Art that was artistic, art that was theological. You might have a picture of David, a picture of Jesus, a picture of the person who was the head of David's palace, the man called the major domo, somebody that David was obviously doing something to, and then you'd have a picture of Peter. And that would be to show the relationship. That Jesus is the new David, you'd have just all these figures, and you'd have to think through. Nothing like what we have in America. They were deep theology, and it was good theology. In America, generally, I would say in most Catholic churches in America were built probably between 1900 and maybe 1940, 1950, somewhere around in there. And the characteristics of these churches are, as far as the windows and other things, the art is in every way poor. As far as art goes, it is, to use a word that I absolutely despise used with religion, it is sweet. I've shared this before. If you really want to see the very sickest thing, this characterizes Christian art, especially Catholic art, through this whole period. Go back and look at any of the holy cards if your grandparents died, if they were Catholic, that were given out. And if you have a picture of Jesus, just take your hand and cover from the nose on down. And you'll have up here the face of a woman. That's good, sweet, effeminate Jesus. Definitely the face of a woman, the eyes. And there was a real communication of weakness because of this type of art in Jesus, not enabling him to be fully a man as he truly was. It was, by any artistic standards, poor. By any theology, poor. There is no teaching. If you go, for example, to many of these Catholic churches, the church where I grew up, most of the windows are saints. The windows don't reflect the theology, the central position of Jesus at all. In other places, most of the windows will be devoted to Mary. And this really justifies so much of the criticism that non-Catholics leveled at the Catholics. All you had to do was walk in and look at our church, and you would receive from the windows and the statues an impression that Jesus was the least important person in our religion, instead of we preach Christ and Christ crucified. This flowed from ignorance. Many of these immigrants coming over really didn't understand the church. Their priests were not very well educated, and the churches they built were not very, very good. I've seen some Catholic churches. There's a new basilica, a new cathedral in Baltimore that was built in the 50s, the late 50s. And the church art is just fabulous, the window art. The windows are truly works of art. They're slightly modernistic, but yet they're not that modern that if you don't care for modern art, you'll be turned off. It's just that, you know, you don't have just the paintings are not just supposed to be like photographs. There's a little bit of art in there, and there's deep theology. You can stare at them and try to capture the interlocking, and there is a pretty good understanding of the themes that should have been used. So, the windows were the catechisms. Statues in the past were all over Catholic churches. Today, the amount and the number of statues in a Catholic church will vary very, very much by the culture of the church. If you go down to Mexico and walk through some of the churches there, you'll be astounded at the number of statues. I think there were like 30-some statues, little ones, on one altar. One side altar in one Mexican church that I visited. I believe the Italians would have a greater tendency to keep statues, certainly than the English or the Irish or American churches would today. We've shared a little bit as to why. First, let me tell you an interesting point. The Old Testament says you shall not make grave images of your God. And the Jewish people never made a statue of God. And there's a reason given in the Bible for this, and it's a very good reason for theology. Because the Jewish people had a God who related to them not through vision that he should be captured in art, but by message, by word, that he should be listened to and obeyed. False religions would be based upon views of while they thought their God looked, taking the strongest part of an animal like the lion to show the strength of a lion, the part of an eagle, put eagle's wings on to show the mobility of an eagle, and saying, hey, our God captures all this. But the God that Israel worshipped wasn't a God worshipped because of what he looked like. Even what he was in that sense, Israel was related to this God because he was speaking to Israel. And you don't picture a word. You know, the prophets never say, hear or see the vision of what Yahweh looks like, your God. But they say, hear the word of Yahweh. Listen to Yahweh, not look at Yahweh. As a matter of fact, they felt that if any man looked on the face of God, he would die, because God was so holy and man was so unholy. So there's no effort, no desire to picture God, because his picture wasn't part of the relationship with him at all. There was an effort always, and the whole importance was placed upon listening to God. In the Catholic Church, we do have statues, without violating this at all, because our God became visible then. The Word took on flesh in a form that we can understand. We also will have pictures of Mary and of the saints. And I've briefly captured here, because it is one of the questions that others ask so very, very much, our reasons for this. All Christians, we shared this once before, all Christians will believe that we can pray one for another, as far as I know. The Baptists will pray for people in their community who are sick. Well, if I can believe that if I go up to you and say, would you please say a prayer for me? I'm going in and have an operation. And you die and you go to heaven. You're not going to care less for me, or heaven's a step backward. Your love for me is going to be perfected. You're really going to care more for me. Secondly, your prayers aren't going to lose their effect. When you're perfected by God in his love, and you speak to God in love, you should be all the more effective. So in this sense, we do pray to saints. That's the right part, and I really like that. We have in that creed that we will say every Sunday, going back 1700 years that we begin, we really believe in the communion, the common union of saints. That's all those with the Spirit of Jesus. And anything that helps me understand that I don't stand alone, nor do we stand just in the weakness of our human nature, but every time we gather in that church, the entire body of Christ is there. All of those perfected in God's love, our grandparents, sometimes our parents, our children, if all these who are dead, perfected, who through death have been perfected in receiving God's love, they're with us. They're perfected in the Spirit of Jesus, and they're loving us more than they ever have before. Before, they could only love us imperfectly the way we can only still love them imperfectly. Now they can love us perfectly. Now they're united with us in the Spirit of Jesus. And just the presence of statues of those that we know to be saints helps us remember this. That it isn't just the human struggling church that gathers, it's the whole church of Jesus. And it is really neat being human to know that we're not ever alone. And there are others praying for us. That's the good point. The bad point is very, very often Catholics have prayed to saints because saints seem more human than Jesus, and they felt that the saints would listen. You know, that Jesus was going to say no, but if you got through to Mary, she'd change his mind. And the error of that is really to feel that anyone loves us in their limited way better than our God does in his unlimited way. Mary, regardless, you know, a woman always seems warm, but when we see things like this, we're not understanding the sign of Jesus. We're not looking at that heart pierced open eternally. You know, the heart of God has a hole in it that he can't plug. So he's eternally draining himself completely of his love for you. And that's just fabulous if we understand the message of Jesus. So in this sense, it is excellent if we put things in the right perspective. Saints can pray for us, they will pray for us, and being human, it's just nice to know we don't stand alone, and the reminders are helpful. I don't know, I wouldn't imagine that almost anybody that I know who isn't a Catholic, when their parents die, and if they believe their parents were good Christians or are certainly with God in heaven, would take their pictures down. They like to look at the pictures to be reminded of them. We like to look at pictures of people we love who aren't here, who aren't even dead. And we can feel a oneness by looking at their pictures. Well, that's all the statues are. They're supposed to be reminders. Often, when people don't understand their faith, the good things can become unfortunate. I believe in my own way that there is an error occurring often in Protestant services today. Because I believe that some ministers, through a lack of education, don't understand their service. just as many Catholics don't understand the fullness of our service. When we get into the first half of the Mass, if I remember that, I'll share that part with you, where I think the error, and it's a very sad error that I think that's occurring. Well, basically what it is, from my impression of listening to some Protestant services on the radio, and I'll just share this in case you listen, because they're good to listen to, but so you'll put things aright. They have a service of the Word, and the Word is Jesus, and the Word is proclaimed, and the Word has its own power. But unfortunately, many of their services really become a service of the minister's sermon. And that's the big point of the service. And the Word that is Jesus is lost in this. And it's all based on the minister. And to the degree that that occurs, he's standing between me and God, rather than being a guide to help me experience Jesus, the Word, coming into my life. He comes between me and God, and he calls the attention on himself. And it is sad, and I believe there is a validity to this, because this is how, unfortunately, some of them, what they have to do to get larger parishes. They have to call the attention to themselves and become very popular speakers. So if you hear anything like this, I watch some on television, and sometimes I become a little bit saddened by what I see. They become actors giving a performance that calls attention to them. I've done this, see. That's how I'm aware of this. For the first 3 years, I preached myself because I needed a fan club, because I didn't like being me and didn't believe in God. Now, I'm not saying they don't believe in God. I would never say that, even question it. It's just me. But I think maybe I'm sensitive to this pattern, this need to call attention to self when it's occurring. And even when it isn't calling attention to self, often it isn't calling attention to Jesus. They preach a message. You could just sometimes listen for 45 minutes and you'll just hear Christ or God mentioned at the beginning and at the end, and then it's an awful lot of wonderful ethical teaching. Real nice, you know, a pep talk on marriage counseling. But I believe that preaching the Word is a very holy thing. It's offering Jesus as we, through the Word, as we offer him in the Eucharist, and they're equally holy. And that's very different from marriage counseling. It has its place. But it isn't what happens when the Word is preached. So they have errors that occur sometimes from a failure to understand also. Slightly different from the statues, they are really statues, are the Stations of the Cross. They're a series of 14 statues, 7 usually on each side of a church. They're based on the suffering and the dying of Jesus. The first station is Jesus is condemned to death. The second is he receives his cross. The third is he falls. I'll tell you, some of them are based on Scripture and some are based on tradition. They're not anywhere in the Gospels. The first and the second, of course, would be scriptural. The third, that Jesus falls the first time, is just tradition. There's 3 falls, and that's traditional. It's implied in the Gospels that he falls because he needs help, but it's nowhere said that he does. The fourth is that he meets his mother carrying the cross. That is tradition only, and it's nowhere in the Gospels. The fifth is that a man named Simon is forced to help Jesus carry his cross. That is in the Gospels. The sixth is that a woman named Veronica offers a cloth to Jesus to wipe his face. That is a solid tradition going fairly far back. As a matter of fact, some people claim, you know, that there's the times they have had the image of that cloth, but it is just pure tradition. It is not in the Scripture, I mean. The seventh, Jesus falls the second time. The eighth, the women of Jerusalem cry over Jesus. That is in the Gospels. The ninth, he falls the third time. Of course, that's again tradition. Tenth is he's nailed to the cross, traditional. No, stripped of his garments, very traditional, of scriptural, I mean. Very, very scriptural. 11th, he's nailed to the cross. That's necessary, so it's scriptural. 12th is he dies on the cross. 13th, his body's removed from the cross. And the 14th, it's buried in the tomb. They're all scriptural from then on. So the ones that are tradition are the 3 falls, Veronica wiping the face of Jesus, and Mary meeting Jesus while he's carrying the cross. There's a real wisdom. I used to not like them too much, but I have a mission that I give based on finding a whole way of living the life of Jesus by us duplicating exactly what Jesus did at each of these stations. And for example, like this, the first of the traditional ones, Jesus looking at Mary carrying the cross has really helped me understand something very, very important. Jesus is carrying his cross and Mary sees him. Generally, when the stations are prayed, they're prayed during Lent, people look at Mary.